This Week in Retronauts is brought to you by a grant from the Fully Programmable Gates Foundation. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Retronauts. I am Jeremy Parrish, and I'm going to talk to you for a while. And it's not just me, it's some other people. We have, I think the Mad Magazine term is one of the usual gang of idiots. Please, Who else is here with me?
Hello. My name is Stuart Jupp, and I just wanted to say before we start that I'm absolutely delighted that we're finally doing an episode about PGA Tour golf. I've been waiting for so long. I've made so many notes.
I think there's a South Park episode. If you actually put the disc of this episode in your computer, you can watch a South Park episode.
Nice. Yeah, that was my bit for the episode. I've got nothing. That's it. I've done my bit now.
Wow, you peaked finished. Early.
Yeah.
Yes, and also joining us here for episode 535, we have a new addition, someone who is not part of the usual gang of idiots, but I'm sure will bring joy and delight to the ears of all who hear him speak. Please introduce yourself.
Hey guys, this is Matt Pinella. I guess what do the people say with radio shows? Longtime listener, first time caller. Been working on some tools for the Analog Pocket, and it's kind of how Jeremy got in touch with me, so excited to be on.
You gave away the game. Yes, but no. You're a hero to us all because you've saved anyone who likes tinkering with Analog Pocket the trouble of actually having to tinker. We can just hit a script and then play and not have to worry about any of the logistics of sorting arcade ROMs from 1,000 different sources and figuring out how those pieces work together. You are a good human being who have done a great service to the retro gaming community, at least those of us who like fancy, expensive, modern, tiny handheld systems, which really is all of us.
Happy to contribute. Kind of started out as the thing just because I didn't want to do that for myself. And I'm like, let's post this on the internet. And here we are.
So this episode is almost exactly 100 episodes following the episode we ran back in February of last year that was called High-End Retro Gaming. And we talked a lot about emulation, but especially about FPGA, fully programmable gate array devices, such as the Mr. and so on and so forth. And Pork Chop Express of Mr. Add-ons was part of that. And Joe Mozzoleski, who works with me at Limited Run Games and is in charge of the Carbon Engine emulation development project, was on that. And basically, now here we are. That was 437. So here we are 98 episodes later. I probably should have just, gimmicked the schedule a little bit to get this two episodes faster or later. But what do I know? I blew it. We're here to just kind of provide an update to those endeavors, specifically FPGA-based type stuff, because it's a rapidly evolving field. There's not really that much you can say about radical new innovations in software emulation of retro games, because I feel like that problem has been solved more or less. And at this point, emulation is more or less coming down to refinements. There are still some platforms out there that aren't properly emulated, but for the most part, people have been throwing their brains against things like MAME and, well, basically MAME for 25 years or longer, actually. And it's pretty well in hand. But FPGA-based devices they have different technical needs. It's not so much about creating an environment where software can run. It's about creating or recreating the actual hardware that the software ran on, if that makes sense. I don't know. We talked about it in the previous episode. If you really want to know exactly what the difference between FPGA emulation and software emulation is, we've done a few episodes like this. There was also an episode that I recorded with Smoke Monster back in, 2019, talking a lot about Mister and some of these endeavors. So the information is out there in the Retronauts oeuvre. But long story short, FPGA is a different way of approaching emulation and preservation of games, and is cool and is still kind of in its adolescence. So lots is happening, constant changes, new releases, new improvements, new technologies, new hardware and accessories, and so on and so forth. Stuart, yes.
Oh, it's just from the layman's perspective, just to really boil it down to how I sort of perceive it. I mean, I don't know this for a fact, but my understanding is basically software emulation is recreating something, and FPGA is reproducing something, and that software emulation is necessarily going to be different. It's not going to be accurate. It could feel accurate. It could recreate what you feel is right, but it isn't the same thing. And FPGA, to my understanding, is using the same sort of tools that created the thing in the first place, thus creating an accurate replication of it.
Well, sort of. I mean, there's a misconception that I think some people have kind of been guilty of promoting, that FPGA is a magic bullet that just makes, you know, for perfect recreations, emulation of games. And that's not really the case. Like, you can have bad, inaccurate FPGA. I mean, most of the cores that when they first start out are pretty rough. Like, they're, you know, hey, we got some objects moving on screen, so we know that the hardware functions. But, you know, unless the FPGA programmers really take the time to sit down and refine things, it's still going to be imperfect, and it can still be very flawed. You know, the sound can be off or something like that.
That is good to know, because that was the misconception that I had, I suppose. Yeah,
but I don't know, Matt. Do you want to try to explain the logistics here, or should I just keep going blundering like a bull in a china shop?
You know, I can give a high level. I don't know the nuts and bolts either, right? But I think the easiest way to explain it is half the reason why, you know, hardware emulation, if you want to call it that, instead of software, picked up, especially with, you know, classic gaming, is there's no translation layer between your inputs and the software that's then mimicking the original hardware. So you can cut down on input latency, right? There's no latency, because it's you're directly emulating the hardware via the FPGA chip versus communicating with software, which is then emulating the old software, and there's that little middleman in there, and you have a little, you know, there's an extra step in there, basically, but it's still emulation. And I know, like, I think even analog even likes to say, like, oh, it's FPGA, it's not emulation. I mean, you're emulating the hardware instead of the software. It can be better, but like Jeremy said, it doesn't have to be. You could still write a bad core that has bugs, you know, whatever. Yeah. I don't know if bugs is even the right term.
And there's some goddamn amazing emulation, exactly. Like, software emulation out
yes,
there.
Yes, there is.
Yeah.
So I guess maybe the easiest way for me to describe it, maybe this is overly simplifying things, but let's say you're a person who speaks English and a video game is over here speaking in Japanese. So software emulation is like having a translator who's interpreting for you back and forth and, you know, doing their best to just kind of keep things going and making, you know, kind of decisions about how to translate one term or another into the opposite language.
Right.
A proper FPGA simulation of the hardware is like, hey, you just learned Japanese, so now you can speak to the guy speaking Japanese directly. So it takes away that interpreter layer and just lets, you know, lets the communication flow naturally. And then, you know, the question is, how well did you learn Japanese? Like, is it enough to order a meal? Is it enough to ask for directions in the city? Is it enough to give a college lecture? You know, there's different degrees of competency, and I don't know. I think that was a pretty good description.
Yeah, maybe not accurate, not bad.
But by God, I came up with it on the fly. So there you go.
I like it.
So in terms of FPGA-based technologies for classic gaming, There's actually a lot out there. I put together a list of some recent things, recent developments, products that have come along. But the two big the big forces, the major market forces, if you were, although one of them is not actually in the market because it's open source, are the Mr. FPGA platform and the Analog Pocket. And I guess I would describe the difference between these two. I mean, aside from the fact that one is a device that plugs into televisions and is meant, you know, it only works on external monitors, and one is a portable device that has its own screen, I would describe the difference between these two as, so Mr. is like Linux, and Analog Pocket is like an Apple platform. One is totally open, everyone's contributing. Analog Pocket is owned by a company. It's a closed system, except they did kind of open it up to a certain degree, but it's still kind of a contained system. And a lot of the development that's happening on Analog Pocket right now, the kind of open core development, is still dependent on, there are a lot of developers waiting on Analog to provide system level improvements and firmware, and they've been pretty good about that. But, you know, it's still ultimately a closed device that a company owns. And, you know, so there is kind of like the religious aspect of it. Do you believe in wholly open and shared software, or do you believe that it's okay to work for some, you know, on a platform that's partially owned by someone else? You know, it ultimately comes down to a person's preferences, but I think they're both neat and I use both of them. So that's, you know, that's where I stand. I like playing old video games accurately and with many options. And that's what both of those devices give me. So they're all good in my book.
When I got the Pocket, I mean, I was pretty delighted with it. It's not, I mean, to this day, it's not feature complete. Like, it's not what they promised when it was announced. There's the whole archive sort of museum thing or whatever it was that they wanted to do. That's not really happening. I mean, it's sort of happening, but it's not what they said. And when it came out, there was that flurry of cores for new systems, and then nothing until the new firmware, as you mentioned, and then another flurry of cores. I'm not actually following it as closely now as I was, because it doesn't seem like there's a lot coming out that I'm interested in. I try and use it as a device to do what it's supposed to do, which is play, you know, Game Boy games, GBA, and anything that was ever handheld. If it was never handheld, it shouldn't go on there, because that's wrong. when I hacked a classic Mini, and I wouldn't put games from a different system on it because it's wrong, you know. But I did break my rule and put the SNES stuff on there, because a portable SNES is pretty, you know, you kind of have to have that. I've been really impressed with the cores, the speed at which they sort of came out when they started coming out, and how they did open up the device for me. Because while I do own a lot of Game Boy cartridges, which is the main reason I wanted it, to play those cartridges, it is more convenient to put the cartridges away in a shoebox somewhere and just play the ROMs of the things you own. Naturally, though, you know, after 24 hours, I did delete them, because it would be illegal to keep them on my computer after that point.
Thank you. Of course.
Yeah.
We all respect your integrity, Stuart, not only in studiously deleting ROMs and then re-downloading them again the next day, but also in, you know, not crossing the streams, not contaminating a device with ROMs from some other platform that's, you know, just semantically incorrect. The taxonomy is all wrong there.
I'm sort of hoping that the Analog, who aren't Analog, they're called something else, that it's Analog doing, I think, will release the cores for, you know, Neo Geo Pocket Color and Atari Lynx when those adapters drop. I'm not sure if they're out yet.
Are you talking about Spiritualized, who's very definitely, absolutely not,
who is not Analog?
Kevin Kevtris.
Exactly.
Yeah. The full-time Analog developer.
But I'm assuming...
Make no mistakes about it. He's someone totally different,
someone else.
I'm sure.
Yeah, different guy, yeah. But when those drop, I'm going to feel like it's complete for me. When I have Neo Geo Pocket and I have Lynx, I think they're the only two major handhelds missing. I mean, WonderSwan is on there now, I think, which is great, but...
It is.
It's not perfect, because you do not have all the inputs that you need, I don't think, if memory serves. WonderSwan is covered in buttons.
Well,
the
big problem with WonderSwan, actually, is that...
It's called the WonderSwan. Sorry, go on.
I mean, I'm sure that means something important in Japanese. like your little pocket friend.
When you see a swan, you think, oh, that's a wonderful swan. Yeah, yeah.
No, I think the big problem with WonderSwan is that Pocket will never be able to fully emulate it with 100% accuracy because the WonderSwan had this really bizarre screen refresh rate of like 75 hertz, like really fast. And I think Pocket can only do like 60 hertz. So, you know, the fastest the screen can refresh is just not fast enough to do WonderSwan. So I think WonderSwan games have to refresh at like half speed to work properly on Pocket. But you know, it's still cool to have that option there because
yeah, I mean, is it one of those things where like, and I know how this comes across, and I'm not trying to undermine any of it, but it's like with FPGA gaming, sort of broadly speaking, I think a lot of people will genuinely not know the difference between software emulation and hardware. Like when I played the analog for the first time, I remember thinking, okay, yeah, this feels spot. This feels like playing it on a Game Boy, if not like, but with a much better screen. It feels right that when I move, the character moves properly. But when I play software emulation, it's still, you know, kind of, it's fine because that's what I'm used to. So I guess with the WonderSwan, I mean, I've played like Clono and Midnight Museum on the analog, and I didn't at any point think this isn't running fast or this is running smoothly enough, because I don't know the difference, I guess. So I get, you know, it sort of comes down to that in the end, unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure I've said before, like, I really enjoy FPGA devices because even though I'm not someone who counts frames or really understands how you even do that, like my brain doesn't work that fast. I'm not that good at math.
That's hard. Just don't
I can still, I can still feel when there's input lag and, you know, display lag. And, you know, I had an experience back, you know, like 2005, 2006 when HD systems were just coming into vogue and I was playing SD systems on flat panel HD screens and they felt awful. I remember, I'm sure I've mentioned this on the show before, but I bought a Sharp Twin Famicom when I was in Tokyo for a Tokyo Game Show one time, and I was really excited. I was hanging out with Cat Bailey. I was like, come on, let's plug this in. Plugged it into the flat panel screen and played Doki Doki Panic for the first time. And I was like, man, this really sucks. I don't enjoy this at all. This is just, maybe I don't like old games as much as I thought I did. But then, like a couple of years later, I ended up with my own office at OneUp.com. And by office, I mean like they took the storage closet and emptied out the magazines and stuff that were in there. And so you can sit in here. It was just enough space for like a desk. And there was also this really big CRT television that no one wanted. And I said, you can put this in here on my bookshelf. And I plugged in a Super NES to it and set up Yoshi's Island and started playing. Was like, oh, wait. No, I do like old games. They do feel good to play. Okay, this is good. And, you know, I actually, for a couple of weeks, I just like left Yoshi's Island running and people would just come in and play it. And that was cool, even though it was a very tiny office. But it wasn't until like, I don't know, 5 or 6 years later that I finally came to understand what flat panel TVs had to do, you know, in terms of upscaling and syncing resolution and, you know, why it felt bad because of this, the lag. And once I kind of clued in on that, I realized, okay, if I want to play these old games, I need to do it on old hardware or with the best possible emulation. But I still haven't come across that many emulators where I'm like, yes, this feels right. Like the Mega Man Legacy Collection is really good, but there's just a little too much of a delay between my inputs and the action. And I'm so used to playing those on CRTs that it just, I can't do it. But, you know, an Analog Pocket or Mister, it feels right. And so that's kind of why I gravitate toward the FPGA devices. It's not because emulation is bad or irrelevant or, you know, invalid. It's just because it just feels right to me. And ultimately, that's kind of, you know, what I'm here for. If I'm not enjoying an old game, then why am I playing an old game?
It's interesting you mentioned Yoshi's Island, because the first time I played that game was on ZSNES, and it ran in slow motion, and I beat the whole game in slow motion because it was that good. It didn't even matter that it was running like crap. I was having the most fun ever. But no, I get that. I think, I mean, a Mister is something that's on very much on my radar. It's just that I'm not technically minded, and piecing it together seems difficult, and buying one that's pre-made seems like a racket. It seems like really expensive racket, so I'm kind of not into that. I wonder if maybe if I did buy the components, I would actually be fine. Like, if they fit together with, you know, I don't know how to solder anything. I don't know if you need to solder anything or anything like that.
I think so.
I mean, how high level was this? Like, buying a mister? Like, what are we talking about here? Like, how difficult is that for people?
Matt? Well,
I don't have the experience to build one because I haven't had one.
Right.
I've wanted to buy one, and then the price keeps going up, and then
yeah.
I've been, you know, gun shy, and now I'm like, I should have bought one 3 years ago or whenever it was when I was about to. But there's no soldering. I mean,
okay,
you know, you got to buy a RAM chip and stick it in a slot. And I think it's more the software end of it if you're intimidated by like a command line. But I mean, half the reason why I made the app I did, because I was like, I know that there's that update all script for your mister that you just kind of just hit enter and let it go. I'm assuming there's a bit more setup than that. And uncomfortable looking at a terminal, it might seem hard, but I don't think there's much involved in it. I feel like the community's got a pretty similar to the Pocket. I think you can mostly just plug it in and go. I think Jeremy can speak to that because he has one, but that's the impression I get.
It's very appealing to me to have a machine that, I mean, yeah, I'm going to say it, and I don't mean to. I did buy a Raspberry Pi when they were in vogue for this, with a RetroPie and stuff like that. And, you know, I liked it okay, but it isn't correct. It's a mess. It's just a hot mess. And the Mister, you know, it's providing much the same function in that I can run any of these games from many, many systems, like older systems, the ones I like, the Mega Drive, the Super Nintendo, the Nintendo Entertainment System, I'm pretty sure Master System is on there as well. And that's what I want to play, and I want to play them with next to zero latency. So, yeah, I mean, I'm going to get one at some point. It's sort of inevitable. The analog I was so impressed with that when they put them back on offer, I purchased the Mega SG. Mm-hmm. Their version of the Mega Drive. They haven't flipping sent it. I don't know when they're going to send it, but I'm sitting there because I'm looking at my Mega Drive. My Mega Drive I have at home, which is modded, and I'm looking at it and I'm just like, look, I know you're going to die on me one of these days. That's why I've got to do this to you. I'm sorry. I've got to put you in a drawer because I need this Mega SG. But they're just not sending it. I want them to just get me the goddamn thing already.
Well,
and
you know,
I can experience that in no latency, you know?
If you're really hankering to play Master System games, you can play those on Analog Pocket as a built-in core, because it's got the Game Gear core.
Yeah.
You put in the Game Gear adapter, and then you put in the Master Gear adapter, and then you plug in a Master System cartridge, and it's an unwieldy, stupid way to play, but I can confirm that it works.
But it's acceptable because it's a thing, as you say, it's a thing you could do with the Game Gear. Therefore, it's okay to put the Super Nintendo, the Master System ROMs on there.
It would have been deeply stupid on Game Gear, and it's still deeply stupid on Pocket. But I will say that the cool thing about Pocket is that, you know, the Game Gear was really, it was literally just a Master System with more color resolution, like four times the colors, and a smaller pixel resolution, but it actually, like, the throughput from the video chip was Master System resolution, and the Game Gear just cropped it. So Game Gear games were just, like, you know, windowed within a black border. But if you plug a Master System game in there, it's going to run the full resolution and shrink it down to fit on the screen, which just looks god-awful on a Game Gear. Like, everything's just a blurry mess. But because Pocket has the crazy high resolution, when you put a Master System game in through the Game Gear core, it looks great. It shows the full pixel resolution and everything is perfect. It's like this weird sort of, you know, just an unexpected but pleasant outcome of Sega's weird, weird hardware design choices. And God bless them for that.
There are Game Gear games that are just Master System games. They boot as Master System games. I know that I found a few of those while I was doing my, I'm plugging it now, while I was doing the Game Gear directory every Tuesday on Retronauts.com as I torture myself by playing every single Game Gear game ever. So that was fun. I mean, revisiting that library on the Pocket was great. It's the best thing the Game Gear has ever looked. I have a Game Gear with like a modded screen and stuff, and it's still nowhere near as good as the analog. That's why I bought the Analog Pocket. That's why it's good. It's because it's kind of the apex of all these sort of apex version of all these systems. You know,
the only way to really enjoy Game Gear games on original hardware is to get a VGA out mod and played on a television, which kind of defeats the purpose. But, you know, you also need to be plugged into an AC outlet for playing a Game Gear. So it's just kind of, you know, ultimately inevitable.
Instead of playing, what, 8 batteries? Alternatively, just play good games on the Game Gear and don't play Master System ports because they're never good.
There's that. So we kind of talked around the Analog Pocket, but I think when we did our last episode, the Pocket was still pretty early days, and we didn't say too much about it. And it actually took a while for the Pocket, in my opinion, to really be worth using, just because it started out kind of in a beta state, despite some delays. When it first shipped, like, you could play Game Boy games, GBA games, Game Gear games with an adapter. If you had the foresight to buy the adapter, if you didn't, it's cost like $200 now. But that was pretty much it. And over time, they started rolling out new features and new elements. But it was really when the open cores, the open FPGA, became available to developers and available to the public, that I feel like the system really kind of achieved its, you know, began to achieve its potential as this kind of all-in-one platform that you can play all these systems on the go, and it's really, really cool, including some arcade games. And, you know, the Pocket itself is basically, what if a Game Boy had a baby mister inside of it, and also it had 4 face buttons instead of 2? And that's a pretty cool proposition right there. Like, it plays actual cartridges, and it can, you know, sideload off of the SD card that's built into it. And, you know, the big selling points are that it has a really nice screen. It's a bigger screen than the Game Boy had, and it's an infinitely better screen. Instead of being, you know, this sad, blurry, monochromatic, greenish mess, with no backlighting, it's very crisp and backlit.
It's insane. The screen is insane. Like, every time I see it, I'm just like, oh my god, I can't get over how good it is. I've never had anything with a screen that good.
Yeah, it's super bright. The color is really good, and the dot pitch is just tiny. Like, the pixels, it has, I don't know how many DPI, but it's extremely high. So, you know, when you play Game Boy games, they'll fill the entire screen because the screen is Game Boy proportions, but when you play other platforms that have different screen proportions, you know, you get letterboxing or window boxing, but at the same time, there's no compromise to the quality of the visuals. So GBA graphics take up less screen space, but they still look super crisp and good because the resolution is so high that you're getting, like, you know, 10 screen pixels to describe a single game pixel, if that makes sense.
I mean, yeah, just, I feel like the screen quality on that thing can't be overstated enough. Like, literally every time I turn it on, I think Stuart just said this, I'm like, oh my god, this looks incredible. Yep. Like, every game I boot up, I'm like, I could just kind of look at this and be like, it just looks so nice. And it really is because of how dense that screen is packed with pixels, right? It's like, any game I play on there, I'm like, I've never seen this look this good before. It's just, it's great. It's totally worth it for that alone, I feel like.
Oh, the thing that wowed me about it, and this is sort of breaking my rule a bit, you can play Super Game Boy on it with, like, the Super Game Boy borders and the Super Game Boy features, which I think is kind of mind-blowing. I know it's a piece of brilliant work by someone to make that core happen, but playing Donkey Kong 94 with the Donkey Kong 94 color and border and music and sound, I just found it fantastic. It's so cool having that in your pocket. And it scales down the Game Boy screen to fit the border perfectly, and it still looks beautiful. There's no shimmering. There's no, you know, confusing clusters of pixels or anything like that. It's just beautiful. Everything you do is great on that thing. It looks amazing.
Yeah, that's another great thing is that you can have different screen proportions. You know, Super NES output at 256 lines of resolution, or not lines, but columns of resolution, and Genesis output at 320. But all of those games played on the same 4:3 televisions. So, you know, when you play an emulator and you play Genesis games and it gives you just like 1:1 pixel resolution, everything's all stretched out. It's like those Capcom CPS cores. Yeah. When you go to, you know, screenshot sites or whatever, you always get these like Street Fighter Alpha screens or whatever that are, it just looks like everyone is, you know, like super thick. And, you know, it, like, okay, that's fine for Chun-Li, but no one else is supposed to look like that. And yeah, it's just people don't seem to understand that these games played on 4:3 monitors, so they're supposed to be compressed because, you know, analog technology, screen technology, by which I mean, you know, like analog versus digital, not analog the company. It's very confusing. It had the ability to make those changes on the fly and for it to look very natural. And yeah, not to create distortions and just shimmering and things like that, tearing. And it's hard to do that on digital screens, you know, on really crisp LCD screens, because the display technology is different. It's not kind of making things up as it goes. It's much more defined. And a great thing about the Pocket is that because the resolution is so high, you can play these games, you know, Genesis games or CPS2 games, now that there's a CPS2 core, you can play those at the intended, you know, with their intended proportions without losing pixel detail and without getting that distortion and shimmering and things like that. So it is a really great solution. And my only real complaint with the hardware, I know some people complain about the loose cartridges, or, you know, I think there's different build quality just, you know, as a result of manufacturing variances. My only real complaint is that I would love it even more if it were GBA format, you know, landscape, yeah, as you, opposed yeah. to classic yeah. Game Boy portrait format. To me, like the landscape, you know, Neo Geo Pocket Color, Game Gear, DS, etc. Yeah. Like, that's the way to go. But I get that they wanted the more iconic look, but I wish there were like an alternate version available.
I sort of agree. I mean, I like it because it does distinguish it from like your PAL Kitty, Retroid Pocket, all that stuff's in landscape, all of it. And it's nice to have something that is saying like, we're throwing back to the original, like, you know, DMG 01 or whatever. I mean, it's more of a Game Boy Pocket, really, but I like the fact that they did that. I mean, it does mean that the shoulder buttons are a tiny bit shit. I have to say they're probably the one thing problem I have with that thing, but I wouldn't say no to a landscape version. I probably, if there was an upgrade, the problem is I wouldn't want to get rid of my original, because I do really like the form factor of it myself. I gotta ask, this is totally banal, but which color pocket did you get?
Matt, what color do you have?
I got the black one, just because I don't like having a white border around my screen, but I kind of wish I bought the white one because I think it looks cooler.
It does look really good. I actually bought both because I want to use this as, you know, once some of the features are added to enable video capture, I just want to use this as my daily driver for capturing most platforms. And I know, you know, it's a portable system, so there's a chance it could get lost, it could get damaged or whatever. So I bought the white one, which I have and use and take with me places. And if something horrible happens and for example, say, I'm going to stick this in the airplane pocket and the seat in front of me. And then I forget that I stuck it in the airplane pocket and the seat in front of me.
Drop it down a cattle grid or something, yeah.
Yeah. So if that happens, I've got a black one in my storage space just as a backup, just in case I need it.
I bought the black one because it hides, like, you know, jam stains and like grease stains, you know.
Right. It's not like PlayStation portable piano black, so it doesn't show the flaws as well.
Well, if I've got in one hand my analog pocket and I'm playing like Mario's Picross, the other hand I've got like a two-piece meal, you know, and that's fine, no problems there.
You can have a buddy or something. What is a chip buddy? I don't know.
I haven't got a clue. I'm completely lost.
Oh, I thought you were you were conversant with all those slang terms that I hear, and I don't know what this is. Butty?
Oh, a chip butty. I thought you said a buddy like a friend, and I was like, what's this maniac
Sure, like Mr. Potato Head.
Chip butty is the best thing ever, obviously. I mean, you know, now that you've mentioned that, I really desperately want one.
Right, so what is it, and how would you eat it while playing Pocket?
It's a soft white roll. Which maybe has butter in it, you know, and then you just fill it with chips. It's really nothing more to it than that. Fill it with chips, cover it in some kind of sauce, put the lid of the soft white roll on, pick up and attempt to eat as it crumbles in your hands and burns you badly.
Got it. So it's one of those British all starch meals.
Yeah.
like a toast sandwich. Yeah.
You eat it, and then you just kind of go into a bit of a coma for a bit. And you know, if you're lucky, you'll come out of it. Just want to give a quick shout out to the Retronauts fans who hate me when I go on tangents like this. Thank you for your support.
Yeah, I apologize for my American tendency to blur the distinction between T and D in the
it's on me. I should have known. Chip butty.
Oh, those yanks. Yanks.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I realize that my having two pockets sounds extravagant and unnecessary, but again, it's really about eventualities for video capture.
It's hedonistic, is what it is.
It is.
It's a work expense.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I definitely declared that on my taxes. Believe you me, as all freelance work, by God, it's getting declared. No, so, you know, I tend to buy a lot of backup devices just because I know, like, I'm working with all this fragile technology, and if something breaks, then I can't make my videos anymore, and that would that would be really bad. So, you know, to preserve my livelihood, I tend to buy backups. I had the perspicacity to buy a backup 19-inch PVM before the prices on those skyrocketed, so...
Nice.
There's just one of those sitting in storage. Hopefully, it's not full of roaches now. That's my dream.
TV appreciating in value.
TV full of not roaches.
Yeah.
That's true. I could retire on it in a couple of years.
I'm assuming, right? I haven't looked in a while.
I've been wanting to buy a backup 2DS just in case before they go to the moon, but I think they already have.
I actually sold my. I had a 2DS, and then I bought one with a video output mod and said, oh, I don't need the other one anymore, and sold it. And then, like, 3 months later, the prices on those just took off to the moon, and I really, really regret not having that backup. I blew it. I really messed
up. If my Excel one, if it breaks, I'm going to be devastated.
As will your finances when you try to repair it.
Yeah, that too. Yeah, for sure.
So I will say that... you know, even though I would prefer the landscape format for the Analog Pocket, there are people making 3D printed grips out there. I bought one called Power Up Grip, which I got off Etsy. It's spelled PWRUP, just like, you know, mid 2010s social media app. Just get rid of those vowels, F them. And it's actually pretty good. I got it in white with orange felt to kind of... you know, just to kind of get that aesthetic, like the only good systems are orange or white or a combination, ideally, of both.
The Dreamcast, the Atari Lynx.
Except yours was blue, wasn't it? Europe in general get the blue?
That's why it failed. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, those Master System carts I bought with the blue labels, those just feel wrong.
No.
Like Sega. Sega is supposed to be blue, except when it's not, and when it's not, it just. You got to get away from
that. Master System is supposed to be matte black with the red and the burgundy. It's supposed to look like something you'd find in a really old pub. Like, they just look like they would just fit perfectly. they look so rustic. Don't you think they look rustic, the Master System cartridges?
Maybe.
That's why they were so popular in the UK, because they look fascist.
Is that why it failed in Germany?
Yeah, most likely.
The Master System is weird because I'm old enough to remember when it was new, and it seemed so futuristic at first with the grid boxes and the very consistent uniform cartridge designs. But after like 2 or 3 years, it just felt really like, okay, I've seen all of this before. I can't tell what anything is now. It's just, it all looks the same. So it's this really weird thing they did where they like created something that was very like fresh and exciting and then just kept hammering it until it was no longer that way. Like Nintendo kind of did the same thing with Black Box, but they had the sense to say, hey, our games are too good for this now. We should stop doing this because it's not really that appealing anymore. And they got away from it. But Sega took a little longer.
In the US, we've talked about this before, but in the US, I think it was Tonka Toys that did the distribution, and they just, like, it baffles me that the Master System wasn't more popular when it is so clearly good. Like, that bothers me. Like, it is very attractive, and there were a lot of great games on there, and it just completely flopped, and I have no idea why.
Well, Stuart, I just published a video about this exact topic. If you check out my Enduro Racer retrospective, it also has, like, it's like 50% Enduro Racer review and 50% just kind of like, hey, it's the end of 1987 and Master System really kind of kicks ass and has a great library, so why did it fail? And gets into all of that. But basically, Nintendo did their early distribution through Worlds of Wonder, the creators of Teddy Ruxpin, Who Wants to Be Your Friend. And World of Wonder gave them great distro in the US. And in that first year, they just basically saturated the market. And then Nintendo was like, cool, we can do this on our own. Kicked Worlds of Wonder to the curb, which was really nice of them. And, you know, at that point, they were embedded in retail, and they were the hot toy for 1988. So they were just, you know, powering through. But Sega actually distributed on their own at first. They created a new division of the company, Sega of America, in like 1985. And they did distro for a couple of years and then said, I guess they decided Nintendo had such good luck with Worlds of Wonder. Why don't we hand our stuff to Tonka? Because they make little yellow trucks that elephants can step on. And clearly they'll know how to sell video games. And it turns out they didn't. They did not know how to sell video games.
I have to say, Jeremy, I mean, I did actually watch that video with the Enduro Racer review. And I was not impressed that you didn't mention that you're supposed to do a wheelie before the jumps to increase your speed.
Uh-oh. Well, see, I didn't know that because I hadn't had YouTube commenters tell me in advance.
You should perhaps you should leave the Enduro Racer to the experts, my friend.
Well, you didn't volunteer, so I'm.
It's fair.
That's tough.
I apologize for that.
Anyway, so yeah, the thing with Tonka is they took over Master System distribution in early 1988, actually. So by that point, like, Master System was already underwater in terms of the market. But it's a shame because doing this Sega Gaiden series on Master System, I'm at the end of 1987 now, and man, there's just so much weird, cool stuff. And when you compare Master System side by side to contemporary NES releases, the breadth of the library is not as wide, but the quality and the technical sophistication is really there.
Well, you know me, I love my Master System. I love the NES as well. I respect them both deeply. They're both great systems.
We know the truth about how you feel about NES, but that's okay. You can learn to love it like I have learned to love Master System. But yeah, just like no one had a Master System. And like I said, you know, I would see it in stores and be like, that looks so cool and futuristic. Oh, but I like this Mario guy. He's pretty neat. And, you know, the Nintendo was quicker to embrace home gaming experiences. This is not relevant to the topic at all, by the way, but that's okay.
It is, because you can play these games on your analog pocket.
There you go. You know, I'm waxing eloquent because, you know, this is what I've been really focusing on a lot lately. Nintendo just embraced the realities of home consoles faster, you know, with they broke away from the arcade approach to design. They started offering games with persistence, save states, but save files and passwords, just more substance. And Sega didn't really do that until, honestly, Phantasy Star, East, Wonder Boy 3. So that was late 88, 89. So it just took them longer to kind of say, oh, people want different things at home, as opposed to, like, impressive, but, you know, still fairly limited takes on our Superscalar games. So,
and you can experience all of these games on the Analog Pocket or any Mr. product that you wish to purchase, thus bringing us back
cleanly
into the subject at hand.
Yeah, so the Pocket, you know, I mentioned that I would like, a different format for it, physical layout. It's also still missing a few features. The big one that people are really seem to be clamoring for the most are the screen display modes for OpenFPGA. I've been talking a lot. Matt, do you want to talk about what that actually means?
Yeah, sure.
Explain to the layman.
And I feel like this was a kind of like one of the big selling points to all the marketing stuff, right? Like, pop your Game Boy game in there and, hey, it looks like the old screen, but really good. It's not blurry and it's not dark, but because it's so high resolution, they can perfectly simulate what that old green LCD looked like with the individual pixels or the Game Boy, you know, color version or whatever. You know, you can pick between the different revisions of the console. And it, I mean, you know, from my untrained eye, like, it looks like what I remember, only like really, it's really nice.
When you hold the analog button and press left and right on the D-pad, that's what you're talking about. Switch between the display. Yeah, it's something wherein, sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you. It's just my experience of it. If I plugged in, say, a Game Boy cartridge of, say, Super Mario Land, I'd be able to do that. I'd be able to turn it onto Game Boy Pocket mode, Game Boy Color mode, or Game Boy Original DMG mode. Yep. If I were to boot the ROM of Super Mario Land, I would not be able to do that. That's the distinction here. Is that right?
Yeah. They haven't opened up like access to those screen filters to the like OpenFPGA. You know, I don't know. It's not in the API or the framework or whatever.
Have they promised it's coming?
They've been. Yeah. It's been pushed. I kind of know a little bit why it hasn't come, and I think it basically comes down to whoever at Analog, which, considering how slow the updates seem to come, I don't think it's many people, maybe it's one person who works on this stuff, has been working with a lot of the developers of the cores since they opened up, and they've been addressing like bugs and other issues in OpenFPGA, I guess probably to keep the devs engaged and so that they don't like flee and say like, well, they're not fixing the issues here, I'm going to go do something else. But because of that, all their public facing roadmap is just keeps getting pushed ahead and put it now. I don't think they even have a roadmap anymore. It just says like soon. Like, so
yeah,
I'm hoping it's actually soon now. I don't know. It's been a while since they've updated, so it's kind of hard to say.
Yeah. The slow release for certain Analog Pocket features is kind of frustrating. Because, you know, when they first launched the system, they said, here's the roadmap, you know, through the end of 2022 into 2023, and here's when the features are going to roll out. But once the OpenFPGA arrived, they started getting a lot of developer feedback. Yep. And I think they were smart to kind of throw aside their planned roadmap and say, okay, we're going to, you know, just totally change our focus to addressing OpenFPGA concerns, because, you know, the built-in cores are pretty damn good. Like, they've got a lot of features. Yeah. They're really solid. They're not perfect, but they're really good. And, you know, for the average consumer, I think they're good enough. And so now they're really focusing on, like you said, Matt, keeping developers engaged and creating the best possible environment for people who are accustomed to, you know, developing for Mister and other open platforms. That have a much more consistent, steady state of improvements and revisions, and, you know, have a whole community building together to make improvements. I'm trying to recreate that as best as possible within the closed environment, and, you know, I think it shows, because there has been a lot more and a lot quicker OpenFPGA development than I really expected. And I do know that things are kind of, they've sort of stalled out now because they need some features added, some of which are kind of like, you know, front facing for the consumers, like the display modes, but also a lot of, you know, just bottom, you know, back end stuff, like being able to access certain hardware features. And like, I don't know. I read about what's been added and what people are demanding, and I'm like, okay, I kind of understand what this means, but I'm not going to remember any of it. It's fine. Just make the magic happen. I just want to play, you know, cool games on my little cool system. It's great. Go ahead.
Oh, I'll just say, I feel like that's part, like, there were, I don't know how many betas were on now. Like, it's been a little bit, but they've been putting out like firmware updates that don't really have like front facing updates in them. So it's like, it seems like they're not doing much, but all the cores that I would guess like 2/3 of the owners are really here for only exist because they've been pushing out those updates with bug fixes to allow those cores to happen. So like, stuff's getting done. It's just not like bullet point features are not appearing. So it kind of seems like they haven't done much, but unless you really care about those screen modes, which they're nice. I want them. It's like, you know, addressing dev concerns makes more sense to me because now there's like 50 plus cores on here. And maybe there wouldn't be if they stuck to the roadmap and pushed off, you know, fixing bugs for the developers, you know, down the road or whatever.
Yeah, and there are some limitations with some of the open cores. One of the big ones is that save states and just sleep mode are very limited in terms of the open FPGA cores because most of those are brought over from Mister and adapted for the Pocket.
Yeah.
And the Mister, you don't need a sleep mode because it's a console. Like you don't, I mean, you know, maybe like Xbox Series X or, you know, PlayStation 5 you put to sleep, but classic consoles you just didn't put into sleep mode. So that wasn't really a consideration for the original developers. And it's not an easy thing by all accounts to add. And I'm going to believe programmers when they say this because they know how to program and I don't. So it's not a matter of like, well, you know, if I weren't so lazy, I would just add it. But clearly you're lazy. So what's your problem, developer, giving me cool access to cool games for free?
I mean, save states or memories are great on some of the cores. The NES core, this, you know, is perfect. And then there are others that don't support them at all. And you get a lot of people on, like, for Reddit, for example, saying, like, why don't you just drag and drop the save state code? Yes. Instead of thinking, it's like, you don't know what you're talking about. Shut up.
It's you know, the new tighten the graphics on level 3.
Yeah, it's, I mean, that's probably my most wanted feature after the new cores dropping for the new systems. But I understand that it's not easy, you know, so I respect that. The way I see it, if the system didn't have them in the first place, or you weren't able to save in the game in the first place, that's more or less how you should be trying to play it anyway. But it's a nice feature to have quality of life, you know? I suppose it's not a priority in that respect, but, I don't know. I don't know what their focus is exactly. If it is true to the original sort of accuracy, or if it is to add these new features in, I don't know what the focus is exactly.
For analog?
Yeah, for developers, for analog, for FPGA developers in general. It's like a sort of a meme thing where they sacrifice user-friendliness for accuracy sometimes, or they used to at least. You'd have games that worked fine, and then you'd have games that in the next update didn't work properly anymore because it's more accurate for them not to work. It's hard to explain what I mean, but that was a meme thing back in the day, and I don't know if it's an analog thing as well or an FPGA thing to say the accuracy is king and quality of life is secondary to that. I don't know. I'm not criticizing anyone for that. I'm just raising the issue, basically. I'm not sure if it's even an issue.
So I know that there's – right. So effectively, the way the sleep mode on the Pocket works is it just makes a save state and actually powers down.
Right.
There's no like actual sleep mode on there. And like Jeremy said, if the core wasn't designed to support save states, like it's probably never going to get it. But
yeah.
I know the developer who ported the Super NES core, I think, has explained this like a dozen times, like you said on Reddit and stuff, like it's not coming.
Yeah.
You can ask for it. I would have to rewrite the thing from scratch. Like it's never going to happen. But I'm pretty sure I had read that there, I don't know if this is just like a rumor or somebody's, because a few of the developers are in contact with, you know, Analog in the Discord channel that I'm in sometimes. And I think they had said there may be like some, you know, inklings of like Analog trying to implement like a low power mode so you can sort of put it to sleep. Like it'll turn the screen off at least, and you can save some battery power, but like it's still going to be running under the hood because I don't like there. It's just not software emulation. You can't just like easily just like stop it. Like it just doesn't work that way. So
yeah,
I think they're trying to come up with like a middle ground.
That was kind of what some first party GBA games did. I think the first one that did that was Mario and Luigi Superstar Saga, where you could put it into sleep mode. And it was just like a low power mode where the system was still running, but at a very minimum level. And so you just kept it on and then you could open it or kick it back into action. Yeah. But, you know, as much as of a downside as it is that there is no true sleep mode, I do have to say that this makes for really amazing battery life when you go, you know, a week or two without playing the Pocket because you boot it up and it's got the same battery power as you had before. Like,
the battery,
you know,
is
after
insane.
Using the 3DS for a long time, like that's just a miracle. Wow. Battery power. Like, amazing.
I've got my analog here. I'm going to boot it up now. I've not actually booted it up for several months, so I'm going to see what the battery is.
Months?
What are you doing? It's usually pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's always amazing, honestly.
So the other thing that I would really like to see added, the thing that was promised and has not shown up yet, is the digital analog converter support for the Analog Pocket dock. The Pocket has an optional accessory, the dock, that you plug the system into it. You know, it charges up the system, but also it creates a video connection that outputs to an HDMI screen. Cool. But my recording system is set up to run through a PVM, a cathode ray television, and HDMI doesn't do that. So Analog has their DAC, digital analog converter, that is compatible with the Mega SG and the Super NT, and it looks so good. It only works with those two systems, but they've also promised that it will work with the Pocket dock at some point. It just creates a really clean, crisp, standard definition image. Just incredible. Like, if you compare side by side, I have a Super NES Junior and the Nintendo first party RGB SCART cable, and that looks great. But then, you know, if I put that side by side to a Super NT running through the DAC, there's just no comparison. The DAC and the Super NT are beautiful. So I want that for my Pocket. And then, you know, I can just use that, like I said, as my sort of go-to recording device and record tons of different systems, as long as a core is accurate and faithful, from that one device, instead of having this ocean of devices that I have plugged in now. But we're still waiting for that one. It was supposed to be like September of last year and hasn't happened yet. So that's my white whale. I'm out there on the ocean with my spear in hand, just waiting for it to surface.
I checked and I'm going to report back the answer now. Yeah, it was at 73%, and I'm reasonably sure that's where I left it last time.
Yeah.
It booted straight into the game of Adventure Island that I'd been playing, completely seamlessly, and it was at 70-odd percent. That's absolutely wild, because my 3DS, if I leave it on, even on sleep mode for like a day, it's dead.
So why are you playing Adventure Island instead of Wonder Boy? I thought you were a Sega guy.
Because it's at the beginning of the alphabet, and I'm not scrolling all the way to W. I went through a phase where I suddenly got interested in Adventure Island. Sort of, you know, the direction that series split off into, and you know all about this. And I thought I'd give it a little look, and turns out quite good.
Yeah.
I quite liked it.
Yeah, Adventure Island 4 is really good. And the other ones are actually really good too. They seem kind of dated when they came out, but now you look back and it's all just, you know, oh, this was a space of like 5 years. It's all fine. They're really good.
It's the Game Boy ones that I was trying, and the way you go around on the little map and ride the dinosaur thing. And I thought it was pretty cool. Yeah. It was sort of looking into doing an episode of Retronauts about it, but I think it's been done. So, probably gonna hold off on
that. There's always a different angle. You just have to find it.
Yeah.
So the other missing promised features are ones that I think I've paid for. Have those gone up for pre-order? The missing adapters. So far we have Game Gear, but Analog has also promised a Neo Geo Pocket adapter, which would be great because even Mister doesn't have a fully functional NGPC core yet. Atari Lynx, which I guess would be great because, yes, let's... let's preserve video games, but also five good games on Lynx.
You can play Chip's Challenge. That's all you need. That's an incredible game, Chip's Challenge.
There you go.
And that Blue Thunder game or whatever it is pretty good too.
No, it's actually not. It looks really cool, but it's not actually that good.
Okay, Jeremy. Well, I guess that's the end of Retronauts.
All right, it's been good. long story. Yeah. That's a strange hill to die on, but, you know, I respect you for it. And also a PC Engine TurboGrafx-16 adapter. And that core already exists in OpenFPGA, but I'm sure, you know, the official core will have cool features. And also, one of the more recent FPGA-based devices that has become available is Crix's Turbo EverDrive Pro, which is a standard TurboGrafx who card that has the ability to play PC Engine CD-ROM cores, Turbo Duo, Turbo CD cores, all through the who card slot, as long as your system doesn't have a CD drive built into it. So, you know, in theory, we'll be able to properly play CD games on Pocket. I know that's already possible to agree. People have been like, hey, look, I'm playing Rondo of Blood, because that's the only PC Engine CD game that anyone ever cares about, and understandably, it's amazing.
Nobody wants to play Dai Makamura. That sucks.
No.
Oh man. No. Gradius 2. Gradius 2. Come on.
Was that CD? I thought that was a cartridge.
Oh, was it? I don't know. I thought Gradius 2 was CD. Well, whatever. Either way, it's a great game.
Okay. Anyway, so those adapters are missing. I've been told they're coming this year, but we'll see. You know, things keep shifting around.
Yeah.
But anyway, those are kind of the big missing things. But there's still a lot of cool stuff in the works. Let's see. There's the Tamagotchi Core that just came out, which is, an interesting idea, considering we were just talking about the fact that the Analog Pocket doesn't have a low power mode. It doesn't have like run in the background mode. It just, it powers off when you put it to sleep, quote unquote sleep. And Tamagotchi's whole thing was that it was always running. So I don't know. I haven't tried this yet, but it's like a device based on low power, real time clock, always on activity, running on a system that doesn't really have that. So it seems like a fun, novel thing, but ultimately one that probably people aren't necessarily clamoring. You know, you're not going to get the full Tamagotchi experience of waking up at 6 o'clock with your Tamagotchi crying because it's surrounded by poop.
Yeah. The way, I apologize if I'm pronouncing his name wrong, Adam Gastineau, I think is the developer who made the core.
Sure.
I saw him say that he originally was going to try and use the real-time clock. So basically, like, if you quit the core and came back, he would just simulate the time in between. But I guess that was too hard or didn't work. I'm not really sure. So he basically just made like turbo modes. So you can just like hit the right trigger like 10 times. It runs like 60 times speed or whatever and just fast forwards basically.
You can see the sun and the moon streaking across the sky.
Yeah, I mean, I'm like, I remember this sort of. I was in middle school, I think, when these things were popular. I played with one for like an hour, got bored. That's kind of what I did with the core too. I got my little nostalgia hit and, it's cool, but practically I'm not sure who's really going to use it all that much, right? But preservation stuff, right? It's like, it's cool that it's there. Necessarily going to play it all the time, but...
Yeah, Matt, it looks like you've added some other upcoming items to the list of things in the works for Analog Pocket. If you want to talk about those a bit.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I know, so the PC Engine CD core is in like a weird state. I don't know why. I from what I understand, there's some bugs and the stuff they're using to read to stream the data off the SD card, basically in the firmware. So I don't know if any of you guys have tried it. Like a lot of the games will like skip or the audio will play weird or it'll play the wrong track like out of nowhere. And the developer was working on it would try and debug the issues and like everybody's experience was different. And he was like basically it was like impossible to reproduce these problems. And from what I understand, there's a firmware update coming pretty soon that's going to solve those issues. I don't know,
that's awesome.
How soon with Analog that could be a while, but he seemed to be implying pretty recently that it's actually coming soon. And he's also working on hard disk support for the Amiga core, which he also has developed. And I think similarly, there's issues with there because he's, data streaming, right? So, I only know what this is because I looked it up recently. If you guys know what Amiga Vision is, that's basically the whole reason why he's doing it. I guess it's some kind of like big, like pack that was made with the Mister in mind with that. Let's a lot of the, it's like a front end to load Amiga games where you don't need a mouse and keyboard and they're all kind of tweaked to work with a controller better. I mean, that's the basic gist, I think, but that'll be in there too when this update comes. And then I know someone's working on a Game & Watch core.
Oh, nice.
So I don't know when, but...
This is the layman's perspective, sorry. Yeah. If the Amiga is getting hard disk support, that means it should be able to boot the WHD load ROMs rather than the ADF ROMs, which is much more convenient and better.
I think
in
that's
basically every respect. So yeah, that's great. I mean, then I'll I'll break my rule and I'll have a handheld Amiga, which I'll just play Arabian Nights on for 7,000 hours.
Yeah, I think that's like when that firmware drops, I think it's ready to go at least, or it's pretty soon.
That's cool.
I've seen the developer work on that, talking about that pretty recently. And then I think he's going to go back to the PC Engine and update that as well.
A Game & Watch core, though, I didn't realize that they all used similar technology. I thought they were all sort of bespoke. Am I completely insane for thinking that?
Good question. I don't know. I kind of had the same thought. I'm not really sure.
Because they will you need the graphics in the background. You need like the stuff that's kind of not painted on, but they utilized the kind of, playing them just as is with just the graphics and not the actual visuals is going to be a bit bereft, isn't it?
No, I mean, the way emulators work for Game & Watch was basically a pocket calculator.
Right.
So fundamentally, like the hardware inside is pretty simplistic and all generally pretty much the same. The difference is that, there are no video graphics. It's just LCD displays that are predefined as images. So, you know, whoever develops the core has to recreate the artwork, the silkscreen art and the LCD cutouts. So
that can be done. That is something that can be displayed. If you can display the... It's because they're not software, right? They're not part of the actual game. Am I being stupid?
It's just like,
being dumb, tell me and I'll stop talking.
Yeah, it's basically like you have a calculator and it's programmed so that it, punches in the number 9, like displays the number 9, but... Instead of showing a numeral 9, it's showing you like Mr. Game & Watch catching an egg or something.
Right on. Okay.
So instead of having, you know, a number 9 in your calculator, you have Mr. Game & Watch catching an egg. So
there used to be
7 plus
website.
2 equals Mr. Game & Watch catching an egg.
It's like, because there used to be a website, I think it was called Pick-A-Pick online, that was sort of flash-based. It doesn't work anymore, where you could play a bunch of these games and they had recreated the underlays for them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Underlay, that's the word I've been looking for. And I just worry that if you're playing these games, you know, outside of something like Game & Watch Gallery, where they've been fully remade, it's going to be a bit difficult and boring. But then again, so you could argue that a lot of these games are boring anyway.
There's not much to them, but they're really well made. Like, they have a really great, they have a great flow despite their simplicity.
I agree. I mean, if they drop a Game & Watch core, I will be downloading Game & Watch ROMs for it, which I will obviously delete. But
yeah, I think each individual Game & Watch unit will need to be custom built.
Right,
in
so
terms
it'll be like
the
arcade,
front end.
The arcade games as well, like where they will basically have their own core.
Right, but you know, that's a certain level of like front end artistry that's required. But the underlying tech, I think, will be pretty consistent throughout.
Cool.
You know, the Game & Watch evolved over time. You went from like ball to, you know, The Legend of Zelda, where you've got stuff happening on two screens, but still fundamentally it was like, you know, pocket calculator versus like super pocket calculator. Still very simplistic.
Cool. I mean, that's exciting for me because I really want to play those games on this thing. So I'm looking forward to that.
So it looks like there's also a Vectrex core in the works.
Oh, right. Yes. Same developer that did the Amiga and the I think he just announced it on Twitter and said, like, see in 8 months kind of thing. So it's going to be a while. But he was teasing that he was working on something and it was the Vectrex core, yeah.
I feel like the display...
Exactly. The display.
I feel like
so the display... I saw the developers kind of discussing, like, ways to emulate a vector display. I'm not sure what they've gotten done or anything. So, yeah. That's the big thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be the big challenge. But because the Pocket is so high resolution, you can still get that pinpoint precision, that crispness of lines and dots. And I feel like, you know, the trick is going to be incorporating bloom into it. So you get that kind of glowing raster effect.
Kind of phosphorus kind of look. Yeah, mm-hmm. I've talked about this before on here, but I'll keep it real quick. But it's, for me, the difference between playing something like Asteroids on like Atari Anniversary Collection or something on the PlayStation or on the Game Boy Advance, and then actually playing an Asteroids machine for the first time when I was in New York and seeing the sort of phosphorescence and the glow of the vectors, and I was like, oh, now I understand why anyone liked this ever. Because you know? You play Asteroids on an emulator or something and you think, this is shite. Well, this is boring shite. Then you play it on there and it's not till Atari Vault on the Steam that they actually bothered to go, well, if we're going to have Asteroids, we should emulate that glow. We should emulate the phosphorus, or whatever it's supposed to be, the white phosphorus look, the war crime look. And, yeah, I don't see that the analog necessarily would be doing that. I mean, the Vectrex, it would have had that glow, wouldn't it? It had a sort of... and there were overlays
does,
for those
does,
games
sure.
as well, weren't they? They used overlays as well.
I think game developers, emulation developers, etc., in the past 5 years or so have started to come around to the fact that, oh, the original like visual experience of these games was a big part of their appeal. And so you see, you know, display modes and, you know, attempts to create Like, what was it like playing through an RF connection or a composite connection? Like, you know,
yeah,
creating those imperfections that you don't get in just pure emulation when it's one-to-one pixels. And so I'm not too concerned about that aspect. I mean, it's a question of how well they nail the effect, but I do feel like, you know, the thinking is there and the understanding is there that a big part of the appeal of especially vector-based machines was just the physical element of it, the physical element of the screen. And because, you know, the Pocket does have such a high resolution screen, that's kind of the missing component that we've had, you know. A low resolution screen can't really effectively display sub-pixel rendering, basically. But when you have something that is, you know, like 240 DPI or 300 DPI or whatever the Pocket is, like that's, it's really like the individual pixels on that screen are too small for the average person's eye to see, to discern. So at that point, you start getting into the ability to emulate, you know, subpixels and effects and things like that, imperfections. And so, yeah, I'm excited for that. I think it'll be really nice. And, you know, the Vectrex is a really cool machine. I have one that was given to me as a Christmas gift a few years back. And I think it's awesome, but that thing is noisy as hell. When you turn it on, it's just like, because there's like a vector monitor inside of the damn thing. It's not quiet. So being able to play that without the racket would be pretty rad.
It's something I've been meaning to ask. And again, I think this is quite a basic question about the Mister rather than the Unlog Pocket. I mean, I'm someone, don't wince when I say this, I'm someone who likes to use things like scanlines. Mm-hmm. If I'm playing on emulator, I like to have my filters to make it look a bit more like I remember it. Is the Mister, is that kind of at the antithesis of what the Mister is trying to do, or do they also support things like scanlines? Okay.
Yeah, good. Yeah. It's a per core thing. Each developer takes a different approach. Although I think there are some like kind of front end options that sort of uniform, you know, like create a uniform style, but most, if not all cores at this point, you know, offer different scanline options. And, you know, I think as we start to see FPGA devices nudge their way into 4K displays, which, you know, may be a while because that's very expensive in terms of processing power to do. But as we start to adapt to those high resolution options, you know, displays, they'll be able to better recreate that. And you know, you have people kind of running interference, you know, as in-betweeners between the devices and displays, you know, like the RetroTinks, RetroTink. Yeah. I know that he's working on the RetroTink 4K. I don't know when exactly that's supposed to launch, but you know, I think that will probably be very expensive. But if you plug a device like a modern device into that and run it on a 4K screen, you're going to have just a wealth of options for how you recreate screen effects, raster effects, you know, display imperfections, connection imperfections, that sort of thing. It's really just down to what they can simulate and, you know, how much development resources they want to invest into that. And I'm sure you have lots of people who are willing to contribute to that. So,
yeah,
you know, I feel like recreating the authenticity of like the visceral kind of physical defects and blemishes of CRTs and analog technology, like that's kind of a thing that a lot of people are chasing in retro gaming and emulation and FPGAs right now, just to create like the patina that makes it seem more like, oh yes, this is what these games actually looked like. And you know, it does come down to artistry, technical quality, and also kind of knowing like just a good instinct for what is really authentic. Like there are some, you know, like, hey, here's what old games look like, screen filters and mock-ups that just, they're garbage. They look terrible. And, you know, right. A lot of times you get things like, I think it was the Final Fantasy Pixel Collection, Pixel Remasters. They offer scan lines, but they're not actually lined up to the pixel resolution of the games. So it's just like you have lines streaking through, but they're not aligned to the actual pixels. They're not on the same grid as the pixels. So it kind of misses the point. Like, you know, it's going to be down to people who understand like what the technology actually was, why it looked the way it did, and how that affected the output, the visual output of games and systems back in, you know, the analog days. So yeah, I don't know if that answered your question. I was just talking a lot.
It did answer my question. Though I realized almost immediately after asking the question, I remembered that the Mega SG absolutely has scanline options, and it's one of the main reasons I bought it. So if I'd thought for 1 second longer, I could have prevented you from having to say all of that, and I apologize.
That's okay. It killed time, and that's what people really want from a podcast. It's just time-filled. No, the Mega SG is cool because it has not just scanline options, but it also has like the dithering blend to kind of create, you know, simulate composite video where a lot of transparency, quote unquote, and shading effects on Sega Genesis were, you know, recreated through pixel dithering, which on an emulator, when you're seeing like crisp, perfect pixels, you just have like grids flying across the screen. But on a, you know, on a monitor with a mediocre connection, you had the illusion of transparency and shadows. So, you know, That's another example of developers saying like, oh, this is how this was supposed to work. Let's see how we can do that. And it's not always perfect, but you know, people are getting closer and closer to recreating that.
They do a good job with the Game Boy core, or I mean the built-in core right on the Pocket. You can toggle that. I don't know what the setting is called, but it kind of simulates the screen blur of a Game Boy screen. So, you know, you're playing Link to the Past. Link's Awakening. You get hit and the sprite just flickers. But if you turn the screen blur on, he kind of goes transparent, right? There's a bunch of effects that were kind of a similar thing. They reproduced that effect because there was games that relied on it to look, you know, correct.
Yeah, I kind of first encountered that when I was putting together early Game Boy Works videos and I got to the game Serpent. Is that what it's called in English? I think so. Anyway, that really makes like holistic, consistent use of screen flickering to create intermediate shades. And when you see it on a Game Boy screen, because it has the ghosting, and it takes like, you know, more than a frame for the screen to refresh the display, you get those kind of intermediate shades of gray. But when I was recording it on Super Game Boy, it just looked like a flickering mess. It was kind of painful to look at, and you lost the effect. And yeah, that's one of those tricky, like, you have to understand the limitations of the original hardware and how developers, Canon developers, said, oh, let's exploit that. Let's take advantage of that and, you know, put that to use.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're actually just kind of ended up mostly talking about Analog Pocket this episode, which wasn't really my intention, but I guess there's a lot to say because it's a neat little device and it's, you know, evolving and growing and has a lot of potential. But I did want you on this episode, Matt, so you could talk a little bit about the work that you do with Analog Pocket, because I think anyone who's made use of OpenFPGA has probably made use of the work that you've done with your updater. So I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit, you know, walk us through like what that is, what made you say I should do this, and what is involved in keeping that thing up to date.
Right. So OpenFPGA, you know, the program or whatever you want to call it, kind of came out. And quickly I was like, I don't want to sit here and unzip these files manually every time there's an update. That's annoying. And somebody else actually had made like a quick little script. Cause I knew about update all for Mister, which is the like, hey, click the button and it just does the thing. You don't have to think about it. And that concept, you know, other people I'm assuming knew about it as well. And I was like, oh, this is cool. And I kind of tweaked it a little bit cause I wanted to change how it worked. And I'm like, I'm just going to rewrite this and just make it my own thing now at this point. Cause you know, and now it makes sense because there's 50 plus cores. And it's like, if I was sitting there dragging files manually all the time, I just wouldn't do it. Like, I know some people like to curate their ROM sets and do this and tinker with their stuff. And I'm like, I just want to kind of push the button and have it go. I don't want to deal with any of this. I'll never use it if I have to like manually do all these things. So I just kind of did that. And I'm like, hey, I made some changes to this guy's script and started updating it. And I just figured I might as well post it because someone else has probably got the same idea. And it kind of picked up. And I guess because it was early on, you know, a pretty good chunk of people ended up using it because it was like, hey, this is the first thing that kind of came up. There's another, I feel weird like saying people's screen names out loud, right? Retro Driven. And I think he used to do some scripts for the Mister. Mm-hmm. He kind of teamed up with me and he kind of built like a on top of mine. Cause it, my script is just like a command line thing. Similarly, I was like, I just want this to be simple, hit a button and have it go. But some people are even intimidated by that. So maybe they want like an interface. So he built like a Windows application on top of my updater and we kind of keep our stuff in sync now. For people who want an interface that maybe you can do a little bit more with it than just like update all your stuff. You know, if you got a UI, you can kind of click through and pick the things you want and it's a little easier. And then there's a third one called Pocket Sync, which is another desktop application, which is a bit more. If you want to like pick and choose what the pictures look like when you load your cores, or you don't want to just click the button and have a go, it's a little bit more of a thoughtful experience. You know, he pulls in like Wikipedia articles about the core. There's a whole bunch of stuff. It's actually a really cool app. But for me, I was like, I don't really want to deal with any of that. I just kind of hit a button and have all my stuff update and unplug it and just use the device. So that's kind of the philosophy I've gone with. And it's been kind of fun to like have people pick it up and use it.
It lets you not install cores you don't want to install, this one, doesn't it? You can skip individual cores if you don't want to install them. Yeah, I've used this. It's great. Just want to throw that out.
Yeah, I mean, there's been feedback, and I've added stuff as people asked, but still, ultimately, I'm like, I'm just sort of making this for myself, and it's like, hey, everybody else uses it. That's cool.
Cool, nice, yeah.
So your script ties, it like draws from archive.org, correct? For cores and things like that?
Yeah.
ROMs? So that's kind of come under fire lately, not your work, but the Internet Archive itself, thanks to hack authors who are like, oh, people are stealing my books. Three people downloaded my book from this internet library. We have to shut it down.
Yep.
How, like, has that been a concern for you? Like, where do you stand on that?
A little bit. I mean, so when that, was it like an official rule? I forget what the exact outcome of that whole, you know, case was, but I feel like right around then, I think a lot of people panicked and were trying to pull stuff off archive.org, which is already usually pretty slow. All we're hosting on there is arcade ROMs, which are pretty small, but it's started going really slow. And I was like, you know, we've thought like, well, it's a good place to put stuff because it's like a public spot. People, it's not some person's random server where they don't know what's coming off of it. You can vet the files or whatever. So it's convenient. Mm. But right around then, actually, Retro Driven, I don't know his real name. He actually...
That's okay.
Right,
it is really... Okay, yeah. This is his parents gave him that name. Anyway, so ended up... We were like, well, what should we do? Something that's going to be a little faster because the CPS One core came out and some of those ROMs are... They're not big, but they're, I don't know, 20 megs. And it would be like, oh man, this is going really slow here. So we added in an option where you can just supply your own archive if you want, which can include any arbitrary URL. So if you could have your own stuff hosted on your network and you just want to pull your ROMs off there, it'll be faster, right? So I added that option in there and he mirrored all the files on a personal site. So that's already like kind of the first pivot we did there where it's like, well, we need to have backups of this somewhere. So I basically just added in the option where you can just supply any site you want. So problem solved. Cool. If for some reason archive.org goes down and I don't feel like updating this anymore, you can just plug in any address you want and it'll keep working. So that was kind of the solution we had there. And I feel like it's good enough, right? I'm not sure what happens if archive goes down though. I mean, that would affect a lot of stuff beyond just this, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a much bigger issue than just that. But of course, all of us who are playing these arcade cores have the original boards and are just dumping them, the files ourselves,
yes,
because that's the legal way to do it.
Yeah. They're in my closet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So anyway, that's a lot about Analog Pocket. I do want to touch on just a few little things that have kind of happened with Mister lately, because it's, you know, there's more happening all the time on Mister, but just in the past like couple of months, there's interesting new releases and interesting teases of the future. I think the big releases are that Jotego has publicly started to release superscalar cores beginning with Outrun, and That's amazing. Like those, I think those are still not quite working 100%, but they're getting much closer. And, you know, the ability to play Outrun Space Harrier, Enduro Racer, you know, that kind of thing, that's very promising and very exciting. I know also there's a TMNT core that is based on the Ninja Turtles arcade game. Is that complete or is it just, you know, kind of in beta? I think it's just in beta right isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a Mister. I saw some chatter about it online. I think he just put, the developer just put up like the first beta, so I don't think it's fully functional, but it's, you know, it's usable.
But the cool thing about Mister. Arcade Core is that once the developers for a core lock down, you know, a desirable game, it opens the door for all the other games on that board, on that platform, to become available. And, you know, there's usually some tweaking involved. You know, there's some minor variances between different boards, you know, like this one has more RAM or it has an extra sound processor. But this opens the door for things like, you know, just a bunch of really cool Konami games from about 1990, like Aliens, Gradius 3, Devastators, Thunder Cross, Super Contra, The Simpsons. So, you know, really appealing, desirable games becoming available sometime in the near future. And that's great. Let's see, other kind of major arcade releases coming up or recently released, Arkanoid 2, which has come hand in hand with refined USB spinner options, which is, you know, that's great news for anyone who likes to play games like Tempest. I know there's a bunch of Atari cores and some other games that are, you know, based on spinners. And there's a few pretty good spinner options out there, like the Taito Egret Mini 2 spinner is awesome. There's an Atari Fight Stick that comes with like a spinner, a trackball, and like, you know, arcade 6-button controller setup. It's kind of elaborate and extreme, and it's a very chunky stick, but I bought one when it was on sale for half price for a little while. And it's pretty great. I need to get that plugged into my Mister and try it out because it didn't quite work before. But, you know, the prospect of the trackball and the spinner on that working correctly for something like Arkanoid 2 seems very cool. What else? Someone has begun work on a Virtual Boy core, which, you know, everyone needs. And that actually kind of reminds me
amazing.
Of I wonder how they're going to tackle the 3D on that because there is some work being done on 3D imagery. This I just discovered yesterday when I published my my video on Missile Defense 3D for Master System and the Sega 3D glasses. I couldn't figure out how to get those 3D glasses working with the Mister core because the Sega 3D glasses plug in through to the hardware through the card slot, which there's no physical way to do that on Mister, but according to Porkchop Express, they're working to get 3D integration, 3D glasses support for the active shutter system glasses through other means. Apparently, you can get a serial adapter for Famicom accessories, which means you can use the Famicom 3D system, which is exactly the same technology as Sega's 3D glasses, and they have some other options that they're trying to get integrated. So I feel like if they nail that, then that is a great solution for Virtual Boy. It's not 100% accurate, but having like an active shutter system, you know, you'd lose half the frames, but you'd still get the 3D effect without having to have like two screens separated together on your eyes or whatever. Mm. So that's very promising. And also apparently Roger Pape, I think that's how you pronounce his name, is exploring the possibility of Nintendo 64 cores on Mister. That seems like it's probably above Mister's weight class. I mean, the Saturn and PlayStation cores are really kind of pushing it as it is and require a lot of workarounds and contingencies, but God bless them if they can get that happening.
So Mister at the moment, that's essentially Mega Drive, Super Nintendo, and backwards in terms of what it can run? Or
I mean, no, it has a pretty good PlayStation core. It's not 100%, but
right.
It can run a lot of stuff. The Saturn core is improving, so you know, you're getting up to that point. I don't think there's like a 3DO core or CDI core, but something about a CDI core. I mean, you know, it's out there. There's some talk about Jaguar.
I mean, Jaguar is only recently, even software emulation has been an absolute mess until relatively recently. There's a new, let's forget the name of it, but there's a new Jaguar emulator that's really impressive. I forget the name of.
Yeah, that's being true to the hardware, an absolute mess. But yeah, like basically, if it's out there, someone's going to go for it. I think the big challenges are some of the really weird edge case systems, like you know, the ones that I've been kind of doing on the side with my Patreon channel videos for, like the Epoch Cassette Vision and Gakken TV Boy. Those are systems where the CPUs were actually. The CPU and RAM were actually in the cartridges, the individual cartridges. So you have like the system, but it's really just a power supply and a video output and a controller connection. And then you have the actual hardware, which is in the software, the cartridges. So each of those has to be kind of emulated at a different level. And Kevin Bunch recently mentioned on our Atari Archive episode that there is software emulation for like all the Cassette Vision games have been dumped. Right. And recreated. So, you know, if someone decides, I want to put together FPGA emulation simulation for these 11 games on an obscure system that no one in America has ever heard of, then maybe that'll happen someday. But yeah, it's really like the main bases have been kind of covered. And it's just, you know, Mister's getting into that point where it's refinement and then filling out the edge cases and then exploring new plateaus, new horizons in arcade emulation. Anyway, honestly, that's probably enough of an update. There's some other stuff out there, like FPGA things. Like the Memcard GC, which is a high-capacity memory card for GameCube, which is FPGA-based. There's a 64 Nintendo 64 add-on, an HD output mod for GameCube that outputs high-definition video 720p or 1080i by way of an FPGA. There's nice. What else? The Atari 7800 game drive from Retro HQ, which is in development, an SD card flash ROM system basically for the Atari 7800, which is FPGA based. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff happening in this kind of FPGA space beyond Analog Pocket, but it's all kind of highly specific instances. Again, FPGA is not a magic bullet that can just do anything, but it's very valuable. Like, the technology is very useful in certain applications and very versatile. So, yeah, it's cool to see just how much this field of retro game, retro hardware recreations and emulations has expanded in the past decade. I've mentioned this before, and I will keep saying it. When I started doing Game Boy Works in 2014, there weren't options out there. Like, to record Game Boy footage, you know, I had to get a Super NES Junior and a Super Game Boy and then run it through a FrameMeister to upscale it. Wow. And there are so many more options for recording, you know, Super Game Boy now. It's great. And every platform is like that. And it's you know, having been kind of seeking this high-quality video capture for nearly a decade now, it's just a wealth of options are available. The only thing that makes me sad is, like, there's all these things that I've kind of tucked away as projects and, like, I'm going to do this and spent a lot of money getting them together and haven't had a chance to do them yet. And now it's going to be just trivial for people to do it themselves. And I feel less special now. But that's okay, because, you know, I'm not like hoarding access to video games. That's stupid. I want availability of classic games for as many people as possible and for people to be able to enjoy, you know, the great games of the past, the bad games and interesting, weird, terrible, misguided games of the past.
Hell yeah.
In a very faithful, authentic sort of way. And that's becoming more and more accessible, because, you know, a lot of times to really understand classic games, you need to experience them the way they were originally presented. Just like running an emulator on a computer with display lag and just like chunky 1-to-1 pixels at a weird proportion, it's just not accurate. But, you know, it's like with the Vectrex and Asteroids and that sort of thing. Like, getting that experience, the real thing, is increasingly difficult these days, but it's really essential to understanding their appeal. And I'm really grateful for all the developers out there, both, you know, the ones who do it out of the goodness of their heart and their free time, and the ones who are paid to do it, to try to recreate that as much as possible. There's so many problems in the world today, but at least people are trying to solve that problem. Anyway, that's it for me. Any final thoughts, guys?
I've learned a lot today about FPGA, and I'm grateful. Thank you.
Oh, I'm glad I could rant for an hour and a half.
I think what I'll say is, especially sort of being in the little, tiny community for the Analog Pocket stuff, working on the updater, like realizing, like, oh, these things are all made by like basically like the same four people, right? Like, it seems like a lot of work is done by a lot of people, but it's like really just like a handful of people doing all this. So, you know, check out their Patreons or whatever.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, GitHub pages and donate or whatever. Cause, you know, if three of them quit, there's not gonna be any more cores. Like, it's similar for Mister. It's like, it's really only a handful of people, cause it's a pretty specialized, complicated skill doing the FPGA stuff. Like, I couldn't even begin to tell you how it works. So yeah, like, support the devs working on this stuff, because they're really carrying everything on their shoulders. And it's like, it's just a real, like, you know, passion project thing for most of them. So
yeah, if I look at my Patreon donations and GitHub donations every month, I'm probably tossing like $100 toward each of these developers, or like all the developers combined. But, you know, I'm happy to do that. Like, I get so much more value out of that, just, you know, in terms of the money I make off of the work that I do with their technology and their creations. So yeah, I really strongly encourage people to support people like Jotego, Roger Pape, let's see, Matthew Gastineau, et cetera, et cetera. Like, just all the folks out there using their time to create emulation, or, you know, FPGA cores and emulators, and, you know, just technologies to bring these things to us, to allow us to experience great games in an increasingly authentic way.
I'm happy that I got what they're claiming is one of the last run of Mega SGs, and I've not used a Mega SG. I can only hope that it's good. And I'm excited to play.
It is good.
It is. That's great. And, you know, I recently managed to secure one of the sort of holy grail cartridges, which is Radical Rex, a PAL version of Radical Rex. And I will play Radical Rex at the highest possible fidelity. And I will feel like I'm using this technology for the good, you know?
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how the developers would have wanted it.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think that wraps it up for this episode. So this is a patron-exclusive episode. Therefore, we do not need to tell you, the listener of this episode, how to find this episode, because you already found it, which means you already support Retronauts, and we thank you for that. We appreciate your support, but please also share some support with the FPGA developers, because they deserve it too. They're the ones who make it easier for us to talk about the things that you're paying to hear. So anyway, yeah, it's just one big circle of love. Anyway, Matt, where can we find you on the internet and support you?
I'm not really present on the internet all that much. I mean, I technically have a Twitter, M Pannella, P-A-N-N-E-L-L-A. We usually just use it to read.
I was thinking more like GitHub, really.
But I was going to say, yeah, you can check out my GitHub. It's just my name, M-A-T-T, Matt Pannella, P-A-N-N-E-L-L-A. This project is the only thing really on there. But hey, if you want to, you know, check out the updater, I technically have a donation link on there, because people have asked. I kind of feel weird even asking for it. I really don't need anything. Give the money to the core developers.
No, everyone, please donate to Matt. He's doing great work.
Donate,
and his efforts have really made the Analog Pocket Open FPGA core a pleasant and seamless place to play video games. So, Matt, thanks for your work.
Absolutely. Oh, you know what? I guess if you do want to actually chat with me for something, the Discord server where all the core developers pretty much hang out is kind of where you could find me. It's FP gaming, right? FPGA, but turn the GA into the word gaming.
I love it.
I don't know if it's a publicly available thing. I'm sure if you Google it, you could find it. Everybody on there is super cool. It's a pretty small server. So if you wanted to talk to me for some reason, I'll be on there if you want to complain about a bug in the app.
I've also seen you on the Retronauts Discord, which anyone listening to this episode has access to.
Yes. Oh, duh. Right.
So yeah, bug them there. You know, that's easy.
Yeah, there you go. Wherever you want to bug me about bugs, go for it. I'll ignore you and say, I'll get to it eventually.
Stuart, where can we find you, as if we don't know already?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter as Chupacabra, where I'm just an absolute obnoxious terror. And you can read my book, All Games Are Good, when it comes out in June?
End of June.
Oh, my God, I'm so excited. You have to buy every single copy so that they sell out, and we have to go to second print, and I become unfathomably wealthy.
That's the goal.
No, seriously, though, it's a good book.
It is. I edited it, and I enjoyed it.
It's the book equivalent of my rambling digressions, basically, in which I get excited and immediately start talking about something else. You'll like it. It's fun.
And finally, you can find me in the usual places. That includes here on this podcast, at Limited Run Games, on my YouTube channel, and I guess on Twitter, GameSpite. Yeah, I don't know. Anyway. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Hope you enjoyed this refresher on technologies. However you choose to play classic video games, just keep playing them because they're great. And we all love them. All right. Thanks, everyone. We'll be back again with a podcast on Monday. Look forward to it.